It's time.
It's time.
It's time. It's time.
It's time.
Time.
It's time.
Time to think about the things that you otherwise wouldn't say. Lucky for us, these two will say anything.
Come on!
It's time for The Fawcast with Chris Williams and Mark Charter. The Fawcast is powered by Charterhouse Real Estate. Why pay 7% to list your home? Choose the flexible 5 or 6% plan for you at charterhouseiowa.com. Hear more from Mark following this episode.
Listen very carefully.
Shall we do this then?
No, just take it one time.
An audio experience unlike any other starts now.
We got a special guest with us. It was just Mark and I doing solo last week, but we got the Woodman.
Well, let's redefine special, because I feel like that's an oversell.
Is that an official nickname, the Woodman?
That's just what Chris calls me.
I've called you that. It's not
legit
even
since college.
It's not even a sexual thing.
Like, no,
it's not even making fun of Woody. It's I just call you the Woodman.
Yeah, that's since I was playing.
Yeah.
Imagine how great your call would have been with Walters on that touchdown against Okie State. The Woodman flies over the goal line. That's not how I remember it going, though. You know, you learn something every day.
Oh, the Woodman. Welcome, Jeff.
It's good to be here.
He's not here for this reason, but I think it's you know, I'm okay. You know me well enough, Williams, to know that I'm okay with who I am as a person.
Yeah, he opens up.
I went on here and said that I was going to be able to do a muscle up, no problem.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
That was not the case.
We went to Woody's gym, and I attempted, and he can take it from here.
Yeah, so in order to do a muscle up, for those of you that don't know what that is, essentially there's two circles hanging above your head. You grab those circles, and then you put your body above the circles.
So you hang,
you hang
to start.
You hang from the start, and then you pull yourself above those rings. Now, Mark got part one of that. He got his body to the ring. So credit, like, that was a strict pull-up. He got the rings to about his chest, but after three different attempts, never quite got over the hump.
Oh, yeah.
To get over the top of it. So not a bad – I mean, I won't talk shit in the sense of saying that was a bad attempt. It was just there ain't no way he was going to get a muscle up.
So what I learned is that it's definitely a combination of strength. You have to be strong to do one. There's
Correct.
No question about it.
Correct.
But also
proportionally
strong. There is technique, though, too.
There is quite a bit of technique, yeah. So it's imagine like trying to do – if you do a push-up with your hands underneath your body, or you do a push-up with your hands 5 feet outside your torso, you're stronger closer.
Yeah.
So when you do those rings, if your rings get all squirrely and get really wide, it's damn near impossible to do it.
So what he did, he showed me how to do it, and actually you were working out with the guy there that was strong and, like he said, 165 pounds.
Yeah.
That did him very,
buddy,
very
buddy
easily.
Yeah.
Oh,
old Garrett Starr.
He looked like a gymnast, by the way.
He's about 5'7", about 5'8", about a buck 65.
And you told me half the his ability to do it, obviously he's strong, but half the ability to do it is body weight,
mm-hmm.
right? He's 165. The day I did it, I think I'm 205.
Yeah.
If you're 165 and still strong, you're less weight to, mm-hmm. to get up there, and it's easier. But that was my first time in a gym in a few years, so it felt good to go in there.
It smelled great, didn't it?
Woody was working out like a freaking madman when I got in there.
He does that.
Like, just it was one of those things where, like, you look at him, and it makes you want to puke because of how hard it looks. I'm like,
it was,
I don't
want to
do that.
To be fair, and so for those of you who don't know, I think Chris has probably said it enough of times before that, so I work at a CrossFit gym, and CrossFit workouts are generally, they're not structured in the same way that, like, say you're going to Aspen, you're going to Lifetime Fitness, where you're just going to do five sets of X in an hour and a half, where we're still going to try and get a good amount of functional movement and necessary movement, but it's going to be time limited to force you to actually get your heart rate up. So to be fair, it was a 14-minute workout that Mark walked in on minute 12 of.
Yeah.
So I was already
pretty brutal.
Gassed by the time I got there and sufficiently sweaty.
It did not make me want to join a gym. Let's put it that way.
I love that gym. I wish I could get in there more like I used to. I just don't have time anymore. But I'm the type where I just know if I'm going to like a 24-hour place, that once I get to a certain level, I'll just quit. I just know that. I like going in there because then you've got like 10 other people doing the same thing as you, and they're all dying just like you are. And you've got all levels. You've got really good athletes, and then you've got soccer moms.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got fat guys like me. So it works out.
You're just working out to be able to keep drinking, man. I appreciate that.
Yep. You exercise so you can have Oreos.
That really is what I do. And I still get fat.
Confession is the same thing as I do.
Do you guys have a week?
I'm already planning my lunch today. I'm going to go get tacos. That is
Fuzzies?
My lunch. Yeah, likely Fuzzies and Ankeny, yeah.
Damn right you are.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite snack food? I ask people this from time to time. Is there one that's like, that's my weakness?
Are we talking, define snack food?
Like candy chips, I've cookies.
Got Doritos are my.
Doritos?
Yeah.
If you give me this sounds a little prissy, a little pretentious.
Okay.
But if it's in front of me.
Yep.
No matter how hungry I am, I'll eat it. It's like a good, like a pineapple salsa.
Really?
And hint of lime or Tostitos. If that is in front of me, at no point, no matter how hungry I am, I will eat that.
See, that almost sounds healthy. Like I would say the same for like guac.
Not when you eat an entire family size bag to yourself.
Yeah, that's not good.
See, that's my thing is I'll just aimlessly meander around and finish an entire hint of lime bag.
I'm more of a colorful snack eater. If it's full of color, like Skittles, like a Mike and Ike's, like a whatever, that's it. Now, with that being said, certain chips, Fritos, I like Fritos. Doritos are great. I mean,
I will say
honest.
This too.
I think Doritos are the greatest.
Ruffles with AE Party Dip. I don't know if you ever eat that stuff.
Another weakness is you get Fritos and then you get the sour cream and onion. Like soup mix, like French onion soup mix, and mix it in with sour cream.
Yeah,
make your own sour cream and onion dip. Fritos and that. Ugh,
I'm getting hungry.
It's pre lunch.
I'm on a juice cleanse.
Are you just juice?
Corey got me on one.
How come you're always on something?
I just like to do different.
Like, just
things.
Be happy with who you are, man. You're a good guy.
It's not. It's more of a because I drink a lot.
Yeah.
Recently, and I just wanted to like. Actually, I don't feel bad at all. I'm only doing it for like a day and a half.
By the way, speaking of Corey, I'm gonna plug something here that we came up with. It's not official. Well, it is official. I'm talking about it. It's just not officially in place yet.
Oh, okay. So that thing you told me about.
Yeah. So we talk about the juice company a lot. It's just down the road from our offices here, and we're gonna do something. I'm structuring it where if you buy a house through us, buy or sell, either one, we're gonna make it so you can get a year's worth of smoothies down there for free.
Oh.
So a year's worth, that's one of those things. How do you define it, right?
Correct.
We're talking about one a week for a year. That's still 52.
That's a good deal.
Smoothies. And those smoothies are $5-6 a piece. So you can do the math on that. It's a hell of a deal.
Yeah.
So we're gonna orchestrate that. And he's going to let me put a sign up over there that tells people about this. And I like making those local connections like that.
Yeah, that's good. And just for full disclosure, they don't pay us for advertising. We just like Corey a lot. And I love the product. I go there.
Well, apparently all the time. If
four or five days a week.
Juice cleanse.
It's not bad. I thought it was going to be a lot worse, this cleanse deal, and it hasn't been bad at all. Like, I feel totally fine.
So how long are you doing the juice for?
I'll probably do it until like noon tomorrow.
How long are you on the juice for?
Yeah. We have Hackfest tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I know in the afternoon I'm going to want to have some beers. So it didn't just completely ruin everything I've been doing.
I have never actually been to Hackfest. Is it as it's named? Do people come out there and just get smashed and don't care? Or do you got people that are still trying to win the thing? Are there prizes to be won?
It's just like any golf tournament where
you got a couple good teams.
Yeah, you got a couple teams who take it really seriously. And then most of our guys, though, are just hacking and drinking. I think Fuzzy's Vodka is like the big sponsor. There's going to be just vodka on every hole.
And everyone out there is out there from KXNO. Tomorrow?
Yeah. We all have to be.
Contractually obligated.
Darn it.
I actually had a meeting with an advertiser at KXNO.
Yeah.
And it had to get changed because I have to be at Hackfest.
Yeah. Sorry. I have to be on a golf course.
Darn it with drinks everywhere and at a golf course and tomorrow's weather is supposed to be what? Like 85?
Is that
sunny?
What it's supposed to be?
I think it's supposed to be nice.
Nice. That's fantastic.
Let me ask you guys if you remember this. Do you remember, and I'm bringing this up because of what I'm doing this weekend, but do you remember the first time you went to a Major League Baseball game? When and where?
Yes.
When and where was it?
I do remember that.
I'm taking. We're going to Milwaukee this weekend. Cubs are in town visiting the Brewers, so I'm going to take Seton and Hollis. Hollis won't care. Won't remember. But Seton's six, so he's old enough to know. So yeah. He's excited to go see Rizzo and Bryant and all those guys. So that'll be his first game. Mine was in Minnesota. Yankees Twins. I remember going up there with my dad.
The dome.
Yep.
Gross.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That was my first experience too.
I remember going inside for the first time and just being wowed by how big it was.
Yeah. With the tarp.
Oh man.
Zing! All right, that's
then
a
you remember
joke.
The Unidome? The Unidome when you
the
I think when you yeah, the yeah, I've been in the Unidome plenty.
Unidome is not as wowing
the
inside.
The Metrodome when it existed. The thing that I remember is when you would leave, it'd be super, super windy, like immediately because
the
of
doors.
The suction of the whatever held the roof up. But yeah, what was your first game? What do you remember?
Mine was Kauffman Stadium,
yep.
Royals versus Mariners, Bo Jackson, George Brett. And I remember watching Ken Griffey Jr., Alex Rodriguez, and Jay Buhner go back to back to back. I had a really cool first experience.
That is a really cool first.
So Ken Griffey Jr. was after 1990. So what year would this have been?
It was early. It was Griffey was super young, and A-Rod I think was a rookie.
Okay.
Like A-Rod wasn't A-Rod yet. Like he was still like.
That's a loaded up game.
And Edgar Martinez played on that team. Maybe you know what? Edgar Martinez may have been part of the back to back to back because I'm thinking that A-Rod may not have been around yet, but I'm not sure.
This. Reminds me that
We were sitting in the nosebleeds, but I got to see Bo Jackson.
Aging myself, I remember seeing Dave Winfield play, famous Yankee. A lot of people knew Dave Winfield, but one of the only guys. Here's a trivia question about Dave Winfield, by the way. One of the only guys that was ever drafted for Major League Baseball, NFL, and NBA, drafted for all three sports. He was that good. So, what was yours, Woody?
So it was also at the Metrodome, and I don't remember how old I was. I think I was like. Junior high-ish, upper elementary, and it was Twins Angels, and it was Torrey Hunter bobblehead night, and I think my mom still has the bobblehead.
Yeah.
And the only really thing that I remember from that, outside of like the experience of being in the dome, was that Torrey Hunter got ejected for charging the mound on Torrey Hunter bobblehead night.
That's sweet.
That's awesome.
Because he got beaned.
That's
and
great.
So yeah, he charged the mound, and so I remember seeing like looking at this bobblehead. Watching that guy like try and kick someone's ass on the mound.
Good for Torrey Hunter.
So yeah, Torrey Hunter got ejected on Torrey Hunter bobblehead night. That's my first experience in a Major League Baseball game.
That's great.
Baseball can be funny when it comes to ejections and charging the mound and stuff. So the Cubs were playing the White Sox the other day at Wrigley Field, and John Lackey, who I hate, love my Cubs, hate him. He hit four batters.
Good for him.
One in the first inning, and then in the sixth or seventh, hit three in the same inning. And they weren't, like, at the head. He was just wild, right? So at no point did the ump, because I think he knew he wasn't throwing at him. He didn't issue warnings. Then it comes out, the White Sox take their turn on the mound.
Mm-hmm.
First batter
behind him.
Is Ian Happ for the Cubs. They throw in low and inside where he kind of scoots his legs back out of the way, doesn't get hit. At that point, I would have bet $1 million what would have happened next, and it did, right at his butt, basically, just drilled him. And then the ump gives warnings or whatever. Like, the retaliation. What's dumb is, at that time, I think it was a pretty close game, and you've just put the leadoff hitter on in the inning. Like,
oh, I've never understood that.
They let pride get in the way of baseball strategy, right?
Well, it's the same thing. That's not just unique to baseball. That's unique. You can play football and basketball anytime. Like, some guy say you're playing basketball, some guy drills a shot in your face or dunks on him, and then that guy that got dunked on turns into a one-on-one game against that guy. It's like, I'm going to get you back, and all of a sudden, you have two open three-point shooters in the corner.
Pride and ego.
But somebody's doing that. Or in football, you get pancaked, and then that guy, instead of looking to go tackle the ball carrier, is just like, all right, I'm going to F up this guard just because he pancaked me last time, and all of a sudden, a huge play is behind it.
Yeah. Isn't that part of sports?
Being a dumbass?
The machismo aspect
oh, sure.
of it drives me crazy.
Oh,
being
sure.
a dumbass drove me absolutely nuts.
One of the best examples of that, and I want to hear about this dumbass, though, but before I forget, that exact same scenario happened when I was growing up. I was watching a Braves game, and I can't remember if it was either Maddox or Glavin. It was one of those guys. So the Braves batters had been hit, and it was clear that when the Braves got back on the mound, it was retaliation time. Like, you just have to do it, right? But the situation, I remember, maybe I could Google this, but whoever was up at the plate was a friend of the pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they knew each other. They had been on the same team or whatever. But everybody in the park knew what was coming. So either Glavin or Maddox, whichever one it was, basically lobs a 50-mile-an-hour fastball at this guy. Like, and he just kind of smiles at him, like nods, like, yeah, I know you had to do it, takes his base, and that was it. That was the retaliation. But, like, imagine you're a pitcher. You don't want to hit the guy.
No.
I mean –
makes your job more difficult.
Well, not only that, yeah, it puts a runner on, but you can't always control if it's at their head or their, if you're going to break the bones in their hand or whatever. That would suck.
I just think
your coach go out and go, you had nothing to do with this.
I just think that's
but now you got to throw it.
I just think that unwritten rules of baseball part is really stupid in throwing at somebody, because two things. One, does getting hurt with a baseball hurt a little bit? Even like I've been hit it.
Yeah.
I think somebody. One of those Johnston studs when they were back when I was playing, yep. I think I got hit in like the back at like 87, 88 miles an hour. Does it hurt a little bit? You go, ow. And then you get to first and you go, all right, that's it. I'm standing on first. I just beat you.
Yeah.
Like it serves no purpose. It's like slapping someone in the face. Oh, shoot. This is a moderate inconvenience for something you're really mad about.
I know.
Like it doesn't serve any purpose at all. Like if you're going to do something like to do something shitty to get back at somebody and you really want to do something shitty, you take a takeout slide at second base because that's actually something that's threatening.
Yeah.
Like it's a shitty, stupid thing that like, all right, I'm going to punt on second down because I'm mad at you.
What? Yeah. That's something Rhodes would have done. Punch
easy,
it on second down.
Easy. Settle down.
Mark got blocked by Jamie Pollard for going after Rhodes.
My buddy John Olson was golfing with him recently and said
with Rhodes or Pollard?
With Pollard and said he asked him about it, and I don't think he actually asked him about it. I haven't figured out if he did or not.
Pollard blocked so many people, but I highly doubt he remembers it.
But my buddy said Pollard said he needed more positivity out of me. I don't know if that's true. The whole thing could be a lie, but I said if you weren't familiar with that, I said it's time after the Toledo game when we blew that there at their place by missing the field goal. My tweet to Pollard was, said it's time.
That to me, though, that'd be interesting. Like, if Cole Nettin, who we both really like.
Mm-hmm. He's one of, if not the best kicker that Iowa State's had.
He's the highest scoring kicker.
I don't even blame Nettin in that game. Yes, he missed the kick, but that wasn't the point.
But I think there's a greater point to make here. It's just like if Nettin makes that kick, like you don't call for the coach to be fired that night. You know what I mean?
Correct.
Like
correct.
At some point, if you're a coach, it's just like the guys do have to.
I mean, he didn't lose his job that night. He lost his job in the K-State game.
Yeah, but I think I can make a valid argument that night. Like, I remember doing Cyclone Reaction that night. That night set the tone for him to not be the head coach at Iowa State anymore.
Toledo?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you freaking threw me under the goddamn bus at Kansas State.
What happened there?
Heather Burnside and I had it was our my first time because both Whitver and Chris were both going to be out of town.
Yeah,
so it's an away game at Kansas State, and Chris or Jack, I don't remember who it was, texts me and goes, "Hey," and I knew this about this like 3 weeks in advance that I was going to do a call-in show after Kansas State.
Yeah.
And Burnside, Heather, and I were going in there, and we were like, not exactly sure what we were doing, relying on the producer and making sure like when we're getting in and out of breaks and stuff like that. And all of a sudden we're in the studio and we're watching it on TV and we're like,
well,
what
it looked
is
like
happening?
You guys are gonna have a great
no
show.
Yeah, awesome. That's what I would say. And fantastic show
like,
coming up. Fantastic.
What is happening? And like I honestly like I'm even in the call, like some person called in and talked about like kneeling it down, and like I even like screwed up the timing of the play clock.
Yeah.
Because I was so like what? Just out of it and understanding, like, how in the hell did this happen?
How many calls?
My first day.
How many calls that show said the coach needed to be fired? Most of them?
Most of them. But they were, I'll go to bat for Cyclone fans. And I will say this too, fully admitting, because I don't know how, like, I would assume most of the demographics are Cyclone fans, but I feel like this probably cuts a little, the Fawcast probably cuts a little more.
I'm sure we had got across a hawk or two that reluctantly enjoys this.
Yeah, I think so too.
Every fan base has the really good fans that are like, hey, I'm going to root for my team. Good luck on Saturday to you guys. And that's the good fans, the ones that are like, hey, you guys played a hell of a game. Want to come have a beer? Like that's almost everybody. That's the majority of fans in any fan base.
Yeah.
The percentage of that changes, though, with what fan base you have. And I feel like Iowa State's percentage of nice fans is high. And I feel like the shitty fans are a lower percentage in Iowa State. And that could be rose-colored glasses. But most of the people that called in on that game were in the good fan category of being like, I really like Rhodes, and I really like what he's done and how he took out, you know, after Chizik and making everything back, but it's time to go. Almost every one of those calls was a respectful, I like him, I like what he's done, but it's time.
And do you remember?
There weren't any, like, F this guy, fire him. There wasn't really any vitriolic response.
Do you remember how you guys led that show? I never got to listen to it.
I don't remember how it was. I tried to block that
from my memory. Was a hard spot for you, though, because it's your old coach. And, I mean, that really is one of the worst ways that I've ever seen an Iowa State team lose. Maybe the worst, and that's saying a lot.
Surprising. No, the worst way, to lose is getting beat by 400 points in Waco, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
That was the worst way to lose.
And then they trot you out.
Fuck, man.
There's a bleep. You know how when you follow the games on ESPN, right? ESPN.com.
And so
they have the win probability.
Is this for Kansas State or is this for Baylor?
This is Kansas State. At Kansas State, that game.
That was my birthday, by the way.
I guarantee you
Kansas
that.
Kansas State was?
No, Baylor. Iowa,
shut up.
Yeah. Iowa State's win probability was 99%.
Oh, I'm sure it was.
With K-State like a minute game. And 47 seconds left.
Yeah, would have been 99%. And then.
Oh, no, that I would so much rather lose the Kansas State way.
Really?
Because you can look back and go, there are three things that happened that you can change, and it's we could have beat them. And you still can hold like a little bit of confidence in yourself. No, the Baylor game situation on that one. It was my birthday. It was October 19th.
Mm-hmm.
Flew down to Waco. Waco's a butthole of a town. If you've never been to Waco.
Was it raining?
No, it was cloudy.
Oh, okay.
It was bad. But, I mean, it was 35-0 at halftime. And honestly, like, there was a certain point. Like, I remember I'm looking at – like, a lot of times if we're losing – if we were down, like, you know, 10, 14, even like a 20-point halftime deficit, then a lot of the coaches, especially Coach Pope, would get real fiery of, like, you know – let's go get you in the game.
You're embarrassing yourself.
And just he would start shouting and stuff. But at halftime of the Baylor game, we're down 35-0. I think we have like three turnovers. We have forced them to punt one time. And
wasn't that their first possession too?
It was the first possession that we forced them to punt, and every single time after that was a touchdown.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Five consecutive touchdown. And we turned over three times. I think we had like four first downs in the first half. And it was the most thorough ass kicking that I've ever been a part of or seen in person.
Yeah.
And at halftime, Coach Pope wasn't even mad, because it was like at the point where you're like, I don't know what to do.
There's nothing we can
I
do.
I don't know what to do right now.
Just don't get hurt.
Hefton Walters, I remember the back and forth. I remember hearing that call, the back and forth.
At the end,
where
the kick
we
return.
We score the touchdown, and then was it Eric says, like
– Eric goes, well, Eric, at least we just avoided the worst loss in school history. John said that.
And then right afterwards, they give up a kick return touchdown.
Eric goes, well, still got the kick return. And then Walters called him a savant. I've heard that a million times.
Who was the Baylor quarterback that game?
It was Seth Russell.
Yeah.
Was Russell there?
He was the guy after RG3.
Yeah, it was Russell, I think.
Let me ask you this question. Okay, not that college, you know, athletes would ever, you know, or should be thinking about gambling and football in the same breath, but
why does it always come back to gambling?
Because that's what we like to talk about on the show. So every once in a while, if I'm placing a wager on a game and it's going poorly or the team doesn't show up, mm-hmm. right, I'm thinking to myself, man, I'm so dumb. You know, you're betting money on
you are dumb
on well 18 to 22 year old guys.
That's dumb.
That might have had a bad night the night before. Their girlfriend might have broken up with them. They had a bad week of practice. Whatever, right? What do you think dictates team mentality going into a game? Why do some teams come out from your perspective as a player? Why do some teams come out some weeks when you think it's going to be a close game and they're just flat? They're just flat as hell. I mean, do you think it's, you know, was it a bad week of practice? Have they checked out mentally? Like, what would you say is the reason? I'm sure you had games where you feel like the team wasn't there. They just kind of checked out. Mm-hmm. What leads to that, in your opinion?
Oh, 2 points on this. One, if I knew the exact answer to this, I would put Urban Meyer out of business and make $14 million a year coaching.
Yeah.
So there's really no one justification on it. But two, it from a player's perspective, I think a lot of that comes down to I think Yancey McKnight, who was a strength coach for us, was probably the best at this at anybody, is that you are not your highs, you are your lows. So if you accept lower lows, you will get lower lows. If you accept higher lows, meaning that your dips and your bad days are better than most other people's bad days, then your bad days are going to be better. So it's in individuals and the culture of the team being set. And, you know, whether it's you're in office, you're on a team on a volleyball game, you're whatever, there's a culture that a group of individuals gets together. And if that culture is that is one that accepts low lows, then there's going to be a roller coaster. And that's not much of anything that one person can change.
Yeah.
It has to be a cultural change. And so if you accept, if your acceptance level of your bad days is low and you only accept a high bar on your low days, then you're going to come out flat less times. Like the examples are Nick Saban. Like Nick Saban, does he have the most talented team in America? Probably. Yeah, I mean, that, I don't know if you can argue anybody else other than maybe Ohio State. But also in the same sense, they very rarely ever come out and lay an egg. Like, if you're going to beat Alabama, like, think of, like Oregon back in the
– Nobody crushes Bama.
Nobody crushes Alabama.
Clemson beat them last year.
Right. And
it wasn't a fluke.
Right. And so even with – say, I think Jim Harbaugh is really good at this too, is you're going to beat Michigan from time to time, but when is the last time a Jim Harbaugh team got their asses whooped?
Yeah.
So it's in what you accept and how you go about it, and I don't think that's just the head coaches saying this is what you do. It's in getting guys that follow that and – making sure that that's in the same category.
I thought you
category.
Guys, you had a good group of guys that your senior year.
Yeah.
I thought that led the team.
Yeah.
2011.
My senior year was 2013, so it would have been 2000. The year before would have been not Klein.
Yeah, that group. I mean, that you could really tell that.
Yeah, not Klein, Josh Lenz, Jeremy Reeves, Jacquez Washington, Dion, myself, like Jake McDonough, that crew.
Yeah. That's the group I was thinking
of.
From a former player's perspective, I'm interested in this too, and I like to put people on the spot, so I'll go ahead and do that here for you. What do you see as the difference between, and I'm just talking style here, road style versus what you've seen from Campbell? You haven't played for him, I get that.
Regarding what? That's just a really broad question.
It is, but just culture. Culture. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed something in talking to current players, whatever? It feels like there's been a culture shift in some small ways, just, mm-hmm. you know, the like little things like changing sides of the field and stuff that's coming up this year, all of that stuff. But it the program feels like it's in a very positive spot, even though we've had losing seasons mm-hmm. leading up to this. Are you seeing the same thing? Does it feel like a different program to you? And if so, why do you think it is?
So that is a little – it's a little thin ice question for me because I do still have a tremendous amount of respect for – the Rhodes staff, Rhodes as a person, and most of the coaches that were there. There were a couple we don't necessarily need to get into. I think Chris knows who I'm talking about that I could not stand.
Yeah.
But most of the coaches that were there, I still have a really good degree of respect for and like them. And so I'm not saying that they did this wrong.
Sure.
So this is in no way a critique of what they'd done.
Yeah.
But one of the ways that I can kind of describe that what the difference feels like is if anyone has ever gone through – something like Six Sigma or Lean, where like your office efficiency and understanding why are you doing this thing and everybody understands why we're doing it. And then we're going to the next thing and everybody understands why we're doing it. And we're going to make sure the steps that we get there are all efficient and exactly going forward.
Yeah.
So we're eliminating lag time and maximizing your opportunities. So I think what the description between Campbell and Rhodes is that Campbell's is a much leaner, much more understood of how we're going to do it, like switching sides of the field because it eliminates a little bit of lag time, or like the way they recruit, they know where their advantage is and they're going to have to expose that advantage by having a wide berth of offers and then recruiting the kids they're going to recruit
and
where they're going to pick. And that I don't think that comes from just Matt Campbell being a better coach or a better person or whatever than Coach Rhodes. He's been a head coach before.
Yeah, I was going to go with what you're saying.
And that was one of the things that when – I think I talked to you about this – is when they were looking for a new coach, the one thing that I wanted that coach to have – I didn't care how old he was. I didn't care what system he ran. I don't care where he came from, what he recruited. I don't care, didn't give one single shit about that.
Mm-hmm.
But with the – what I wanted him to have was I wanted him to have been a head coach before because it's totally different. Again, from the outside in, it's totally different to figure out what you're doing on the fly versus having done it before and just saying, we're going to tweak some stuff, but this is what we do.
And all of those guys have been with him before.
Right.
I mean, the continuity factor.
And about that lean, that lean or 6S or whatever efficiency is. If you, I think this is not saying this as in a God's honest truth, but this is what I've heard from a person who's heard from a person.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is if Chris has said that, but in the sense of like, say they're going to a there's an assistant coach that's again, pulling this out of my ass. Don't take this as truth. But say there's a recruiting or a coach that's a wide receivers coach in the Rhodes staff versus the Campbell staff. And they're going to recruit Johnny Thompson from, you know,
from Madrid, Iowa.
From the Woodlands in Texas. Yeah. And then there's another kid from, what is it, Cyprus, like in Texas, and his, you know, Billy Smith. And Billy Smith has a great camp, has a great body. They send that information back. They look up the film. That wide receivers coach for the Rhodes staff and the wide receiver coach for the Campbell staff both like the kid and want to offer him. I think what Campbell does, different to Rhodes, is Campbell gives the guy the freedom to say, if you like and you think that kid deserves a scholarship, you offer him.
Yeah.
If Rhodes had that, I think the way that would go was, we will take an advanced look at him and I will be the one to make the determination on the offer.
Yeah.
So I think talking about an efficiency thing, I think that's how that goes. Mm-hmm. And that's I think a lot of staffs do that is, I trust you enough, I trust your discernment enough that if you like a kid and you think he deserves an offer,
yeah,
I'll roll with you on it, and I think that's how it goes.
This is one of the reasons, too, why I'm just not, like, sold on this Bob Stoops to Lincoln Riley transition is because you've got all these guys who are Stoops disciples.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of
Isn't
a sudden,
there an actual Stoops still? Isn't Mark still the defensive coordinator?
And he's a pain in the ass.
How's that going to go?
That's my point. Like, what if Ohio State drops 42 on him in week two?
And Lincoln has to buck up against old Mark.
And I feel like it might be Mike. I'm not sure. Mark is the head coach
Mark,
at Kentucky.
I think.
Mike is the defensive coordinator. But, like, I feel like Bob shielded Mike Stoops from a lot of criticism and stuff. And he's a pain in the ass to work with. So you've got all these Bob Stoops disciples, and now, like, their leader is a 33-year-old who's never been a head coach before.
Mm-hmm.
This reeks of setting up to be a really – big letdown to Oklahoma for me. I don't care how much talent they have.
Yeah. Or, I mean, has there been a successful example of this? Has there been a successful example of someone stepping in after a legend has left?
Well, what do you mean by success? I mean, look at what Solich did at Nebraska. The dude won 9 games every year, but wasn't considered a success. I mean, was he a success? I would say he was, but Nebraska's past their national title runs. They're just a different team.
Would they give
at this
anything
point
to have those Solich years back right now?
You know, so I don't know.
That's a whole nother story.
You kind of want to be the man who follows the man who follows the man.
Yes.
Not the man who follows the man.
Correct.
If that makes sense.
Because then anybody's like, whoa, we really overestimated.
I still think Steve Prohm, like, he's done really well. Mm-hmm. In 2 years, but it's still a tough job because there's still that shadow.
Even after two
NCAA tournaments, there are people, well, he hasn't done it with Fred. Players.
Another example jumps to mind, unless I'm missing a coach in between, but the transition at Florida State was really
from
good.
Jimbo
from Bowden to Jimbo. Was there somebody between them?
Was Jimbo on staff and got internally promoted, or did he get hired externally?
I don't remember that.
Jimbo came from LSU.
Because I think he got hired externally.
But he's,
what I meant is I'm thinking internal in-house promotion. When was the last time an internal promotion worked?
The Wayne Morgan years? Oh, I should. Like, nope, not that one.
I mean, that's a deep dive into a lot of stuff. But
yeah.
The one that comes to mind right now is Mark Helfrich. Mark Helfrich at Oregon, who, when Chip left, Mark Helfrich was the offensive coordinator. He got promoted to the head coach and ran it into the ground.
He did.
Is Solich really a success, though? Just hear me out on this. Like, I think by our standards, with hindsight, you go, yeah, it was a success. But if you think about it, at the time, Nebraska was winning national titles, and he was handed a national championship caliber team.
Was he coaching Grant Winstrom?
No, that was Osborne.
Still all Osborne?
I don't remember who exactly was on that Solich team.
Because when did Osborne step down?
Solich coached the team that just got destroyed by Miami in the BCS championship game. They got destroyed by Colorado on Black Friday and still made the BCS title game. Do you remember that?
No. That would have been
You're pretty young.
I was born in 1990.
Isn't part of Nebraska's story, though, with Solich, isn't part of their issue, though, that their style that won them those national championships doesn't work anymore? College football has shifted?
I think it's more in the sense of the internet started at the same time that
recruiting changed.
I think they were the CD industry where they didn't do anything wrong. It's just that there's something new and better that totally changed the market of how it was going, because you go, you need to come to Nebraska, and then someone you find on the internet like, wait, what does USC look like? Yeah. Or wait, what is?
I mean, if you go back,
and you go like, wait, I could go play in Gainesville, Florida, or I could go to Lincoln, Nebraska.
Yeah, and it's one of those deals too where time just passes you by, and if you go long enough without winning, the kids don't understand like what Nebraska football was.
Yeah,
like it. Any kid.
I do remember. I say I was born in 1990. I do remember.
But look at
like Eric Crouch. Like that's my first memory of what Nebraska football is like Eric Crouch.
So how much younger is a football prospect right now than you?
They would be born in like 1998.
Okay, so they think of Nebraska football as the Bill Callahan years.
Whew.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, that's my whole point. Like, if you go long enough without winning, I don't care how many national titles you have, people don't know about it anymore.
Which this is probably going to be a very favorable thing, but this is why Iowa fans are insane whenever they call for Kirk Ferentz to be fired. Hmm. Because 2002 when he took over Hayden Fry, that's like, if you're talking about like recruits, if you were to ask a 17-year-old kid to name the five best football programs in the Big Ten, Iowa football is probably in that top five. They would probably go Ohio State, Michigan, Michigan State, Wisconsin, and Iowa. Because since they were born, like when their first memories of what football is going to be is like 2005.
They've been better than Nebraska.
Yeah. And so if you are a Hawkeye fan, that's what blows my mind. Is I also just personally, like going through the recruiting process, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Kirk Ferentz as a person and as the way he carries himself.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I'll go to bat for him, not necessarily the program itself, but it's just a side note because of this exact thing is that he's been so successful and created a brand of recognition for that school that you go 6-6 in a season, fire Kirk Ferentz. No, asshole, don't fire him. Change a couple things.
Yeah. Which they have, coordinators, et cetera. Let me ask you guys this question, because this is what I think about with Nebraska. Think about national champions over the past 20 years. And Nebraska's close to that. 95 was their last one. Okay, so include them in this. How many other national champions during that time do you look at their program and say, within the next 10 years, there's no chance to win a national championship? And I would say Nebraska is that team. There's no chance to win a national championship. They've just fallen that much. They're that different, right? But most of those teams that have won, you'd say, yeah, they get the right class, they'll be back, or they always got a chance at the playoff or whatever. They're the one that jumps out to me for sure that it feels that way about them.
When did Colorado? Oh, it was 92. Was when Colorado won theirs.
Before, or well, 90. They were 90.
Not with that actually wasn't even that far too. Because I mean, not far, but they weren't.
I mean,
that
Colorado
far.
Certainly would be one of those teams.
But
too.
They weren't that far away. I mean, lose one less game and beat Wisconsin Washington last year, and you're in.
Yeah, that was after like three horrible years. But even
Miami, though, you mentioned Rick apparently
also
has a great recruiting class.
Boulder's fantastic.
When these teams switch conferences,
if I had gotten an offer from the University of Colorado, I would be at University of Colorado.
Yeah, it's a
Boulder is wonderful. If you've never been, it's a.
So is Fort Collins,
in Colorado State.
Yeah,
Colorado has town. Iowa beat for natural beauty. Let's put it that way.
Well, I think there's something too, Mark, about when these teams switch conferences.
Yeah.
Because you lose your recruiting base that you've had for like Nebraska and Missouri have both. The Gary Pinkel years at Missouri when they started to win were built off of Texas players. Mm-hmm. And now they're in the SEC, and I understand that like A&M is taking some, you know, Texas players out of the Big 12. But like that completely changed both of those. And Nebraska was doing a lot in Texas too. And then all of a sudden it's like you're not playing down there anymore.
Yeah.
And you kind of just lose your identity on the trail. I think that's a significant aspect of it too.
Mm-hmm.
Just with Nebraska. I don't know. Maybe I'm way off.
I don't think you're too far off at all. I also just think granted money's money, but I think it's also a short-sighted change when you bail, when you are one of the stalwarts in the conference to bail. I understand the financial thing, but like Missouri, like Nebraska, that's going into the Big Ten, It's a much more financially stable conference. And going into the SEC, sure, you're going to get shared revenue, but what are you gaining? Like, in rivalries, where, like, West Virginia, the Big 12 doesn't make any sense. Like, why would West Virginia want to join the Big 12?
Well, that didn't make any sense, but other than money, and that's probably the main reason, Missouri not being in the Big 12 doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Geographically and all of that, yep. Right? They're an afterthought in the SEC.
They're always going to be, because who are you going to build a rivalry with? Arkansas, maybe?
That's really the only team within driving distance for them.
Yeah. I mean, you're never going to interact fans-wise with another fan. You're wearing a Mizzou shirt.
Maybe Kentucky.
But it
reminds me of, was it Diaco trying to create a rivalry last year?
Yeah, Diaco and, like, South Florida or something.
The story goes he created a trophy for it, and the team that won it was South Florida. They didn't even take the trophy. They just left it there in the stadium.
They didn't even want the stupid trophy.
They're like, no, there's no rivalry here. This makes no sense at all. What did they call that? It had a pretty decent name, too.
It was lame.
Something about a civil war.
Yeah, I remember Ross and I talked about that a lot when that went down.
The ass-kicking trophy.
Jeff, I wanted to ask you real quick before we wrap this up, though, about the concussion thing that came out. I know that you're really into this, and I've gotten really into this.
Mm-hmm.
I probably know 20 times as much about this now compared to the last time we talked about it. That study that came out the other day.
Mm-hmm. The 110 out of 111.
Yeah, so clearly it's a very biased study because people who turned in the brains they suspected it.
Correct.
So you can't take – this is not the gospel.
Correct.
But I also think that – here's the only thing that insults me. Don't be Jerry Jones and insult my intelligence and say there's no connection.
Correct.
It's not a football-specific thing. I don't think that anybody educated on this – says the only way you get CTE is if you play football.
Correct.
I don't think that anybody buys that. But don't be like Jerry Jones and tell me that there's no connection between the sport of football and CTE.
Well, and just logically thinking, if you're going to mash your head into something repeatedly, it's probably not good for that head.
It's not a natural thing.
If you're going to continually – if you're going to be a construction worker and instead of using a hammer, you're going to use the back of your middle finger to pound nails in, it's not good for that thing. It's not a natural movement. So, like you were talking about, that's a huge sampling bias on what that looks like, because the correlation for that, if it doesn't make a ton of sense yet, is thinking of a doctor's office calculating the rate of the flu in a community, and the only people they test are people that come in already coughing.
With symptoms of the flu.
Like, your percentage of the flu, 96% of the population has the flu. No, they don't. 96% of the people that fear they have the flu that came to talk to you have the flu.
Yeah.
So... The 110 out of 111, it's a much, 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 much higher number than what you're actually going to see in real life. However, that is still very startling in the fact that if you have a concern that that's going to be a thing, that it is the thing. So there is a higher, again, to think of it logically, is there is a higher incidence of if your brain is mashing against something over and over and over again, it's not going to be good for your brain.
Yeah.
Now, to counter this point, and assuming that the 110 out of 111 is true, which I think you can, it's just extrapolating that beyond those 111 is a little difficult to do. But in the same light, I think about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there's another study that came out. I think it was Boston University, maybe. I forget the source of this, but it was that.
Yeah, Boston University is like the lead.
Right. And so there was one other study that had done basically a cross-sectional study of high school athletes that played football and those that didn't, and ruled that and found that there was no higher incidence of neurological deficit in those that played high school, those that played high school football and those that didn't. So if you're assuming both of those is true, that 110 out of 111 NFL players have symptoms of a concussion, that again brought themselves forward, and also that there's no discernible difference between current high school football players and current non-high school football players, that means one of two things. Either one, the risk doesn't happen until a lot higher number of impacts, and then it starts to become a problem. Or two, that the interventions that have been instituted since this whole thing started is before this group of high school kids that was studied got to high school. So like 2010, 11, 12 is when it really started picking up, and how do we change things? How to remove the head from tackling? How to remove the head from blocking? So if a technical change and an identification change and a culture change in diagnosing concussions and diagnosing head trauma is then those kids would have started high school. This is 2017 right now. Those kids would have started high school in 2013. So the interventions that would have been started for this group of high school kids would have been started after that thing happened. So either the number of impacts directly correlates to your risk for CTE, and that playing in the, obviously through college, through the NFL, is going to be a lot higher risk just because it's faster, you're using your head more, you're doing just a more volume. But also you kind of would have to think that the culture change towards prevention and education has done something in reducing the number of the risk for neurological deficits.
Don't you think everybody at this point that's playing football, especially parents, at least what's changed is at least you know about it now and you know that it's
absolutely
a risk.
Correct.
If you go your entire life without ever having a concussion, I would say your risk of CTE is almost probably zero, unless it's something in your genes or whatever. Versus a guy that plays high school, college, pro, right? That person has to be at least 1,000% more likely to get CTE than the person that never ever played football.
Correct. And right? To the same light, there's things that you can do to prevent and identify and reduce things. And to use a metaphor, the only way to ensure that you and your wife don't get pregnant is that you don't have sex. That's the only way to ensure it. Yep. Because if vasectomies failed, birth control fails, condoms fail, all that stuff fails. Same thing in the sense of football. If there's going to be contact between two people in football and basketball, wrestling, volleyball, whatever, there's going to be contact between two people. The only way to fully remove the risk of getting head trauma is to not have them do that thing. Yeah. So there is an innate risk that it's going to be out there, but how can you trim the number down of going from, to go back to the sex metaphor, going from the rhythm method to going to birth control? Yeah. Is it which one's going to be much more effective in preventing it and reducing the risk? You're never going to be able to eliminate it altogether. That's just the nature of a sport.
From what I always understood, though, is that, back to Mark's point, is that you don't necessarily, the giant hits that knock a receiver out in the middle of the field aren't even, like, those are damaging, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But, like, the tiny little hits, the hundreds of hits that a lineman takes throughout the year, like, you could not get a concussion but still end up with CTE because those all add up over time.
Correct. And then to enforce that point and kind of take it back to that, if you assume one study true and you assume the other true, one of the biggest things that's come about in modern coaching of football is removing contact between two kids or between two athletes as much as humanly possible within the game. So if prior to, in like say 1991, if you were going to learn how to block, you're going to block without a bag, without a pad between you and another person. They're going to be in shoulder pads and a helmet. You're going to be in shoulder pads and helmet, and you're going to hit them and block, and you're going to reset. You're going to hit them and block. You're going to reset. You're going to hit them and block. You're going to reset. You're going to do that 500 times during practice. Now the way that's done is a guy has a helmet on and shoulder pads, and then also a 5-inch bag between you and him, and you're holding that bag off your body, so you take no contact to your head, and you're assuming that there's going to be less contact to the person. So the volume of hits is being drastically reduced understanding what's going on and acknowledging that there's a risk. So secondhand smoke is going down, or risk effects of secondhand smoke is going down just by acknowledging that that's a thing and being like, hey, let's limit this as much as we can. So, I don't know.
It's common sense.
It's not trying to be like a sales pitch for football, but in a logical sense, if one is true and the other is true, there has to be one difference between the two of them, or there has to be a couple differences between the two of them that have caused both of these contradictory populations to have totally opposite results.
You're not going to change the game of football in the way that it's played, I don't think. So, within, you know, given plenty of time within the next 20 years, do we see a drastically different helmet? I mean, technology is changing at a great pace the time.
I bet, yeah. Because helmets are around because you prevent skull fractures. Well, they're not around to prevent concussions.
Helmets are extremely hard, too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you punch a helmet, you're going to break your fist, that type of thing. Can the helmet become softer in some way?
Yeah, but
rubber versus whatever.
You're talking about like the NASCAR safer barrier walls where there's more give. Is that what you're saying?
Like a fender rather than an iron bar.
A concussion is basically your brain bashing into your skull.
It's not necessarily that.
It's the jelly, right?
It's in the stretching of your neurons as it rotates.
So simply put, how do you get it so that doesn't happen? And if it doesn't happen, you don't get the concussions, etc. Can you do that by colliding two objects together, but the material in between is so
absolutely
much better.
And that's why there's millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars in venture investments into helmets. Like one of the companies that – so right now, Riedel owns – they own the market. Like any helmet you see that has the little – like if you kind of put your hand like on the back of your head where the knob is in the back of your head, mm-hmm. right behind that, there's a little cut-in. If there's any part of a helmet that looks like there's a little cut-in behind there,
yep.
Riedel makes that helmet. So almost every single college in yeah. the country uses that. So Riedel is the market leader right now. And so if there's another company called Visus that's trying – they got a bunch of money, I think, from like Microsoft
yep.
to do a lot of reduction in – they having a helmet that's more, like you said, more like a fender than an iron bar, so it gives a little bit more. Now, but the thing is you cannot rely on the helmet to be the thing that changes it, because if we're never change our attitude towards each other and we're in a fight and I give you a metal hammer versus giving you a rubber hammer, you're just going to swing the rubber hammer harder.
Yeah.
So if you never change the attitude or the goal of the game or the impact or the rules or the way it's taught, you're not ever going to reduce the risk. Guys are just going to hit each other harder. So you can't just change the padding and call it good. You have to change the way the game is played. And one last thing, because I do have to at some point get kind of going.
Yeah, we
got to
go too. My computer's about to die.
One last note is that this is going to piss probably a lot of people off, but 25 years from now, I would bet a good chunk of money that there is no such thing as a kickoff
anymore. I agree with you.
And the point to that, beyond that, is if you want the game of football to sustain in a remotely similar capacity to what it is now, you better sure as shit not fight that change.
Yeah.
Because if you are a parent and you're deciding whether or not to play, have your kid play football,
yeah.
and you give them five plays to watch, a run play, a pass play, a punt, a kickoff, and a kick return, and they watch the kickoff or the kick return, there is not a chance in hell that that questioning parent goes, sure, let's let my son play football.
Yeah.
They're going to say, no way. I'm not going to let my kid run full speed 40 miles an hour or 40 yards down the field and run into another kid going 40 yards down the field.
And clearly the NFL has not banned the kickoff, but in a lot of ways they have by moving it up and kicking it through.
Yeah.
So, but if that's true, then they also get rid of the punt return.
The punt return is likely going either that – I don't know if they're going to be able to fully eliminate the punt return because of how it's done, but the rule change is – I would bet what happens with that is the rule change becomes much more drastic in the sense that the returner is going to be protected in a lot bigger light, where if say that it becomes more of a contentious issue, then if you were to rough a punt returner, you are instantly ejected from the game.
Yeah, because right now it's 15 yards. Why not take the shot?
Right. So if it continues to trend this way and the data continues to show that football is dangerous, then they're going to have to make some changes. I don't think you can get rid of punt and punt return because what do you do on fourth down?
I just think you make it – I'd love to see knock off the Pop Warner stuff, like make it high school when these kids actually start hitting. And then I think at some point, I think the NFL puts a cap on how old you can be playing in the NFL. Because if it's these hits lining up
– I don't think that could stand up in court.
I
really don't think you can put an age limit on it.
I'm already reaching the point.
That's capping earning potential for somebody.
But they're also going to get sued for – they're already getting sued.
People can get sued for
my
all
point
sorts
is,
things.
Like, you can play the game, but the longer you play the game, we're seeing that you have a higher risk of this stuff happening. So if you can shorten that amount of time, a lot less people are sick down the road.
I agree.
CTE sounds crappy.
See you, Jeff.
Let's fix it that way. Yeah.
We got Mark – thanks, Jeff. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, not a problem.
Mark's got some great real estate. These are brand new. We got fresh.
They're fresh, man. This one coming up today, by the way, if we did them in order, is actually really good. It's a very sexy topic about exclusion clauses, which sounds horrible, but listen to it because this will save you a lot of trouble down the road.
Exclusion clauses.
Yes.
Right here on the podcast.
Hey guys, Mark here. Hope you enjoyed that last podcast. Hey, I'm back with some more real estate tidbits. I know we missed last week. I'd run out of them. I pre-record these things 6-7 at a time. Today I'm doing 5 new ones here for you. And the first one I wanted to do is on something that doesn't sound very exciting, but I wanted to talk to you about it anyway. And it's what's called an exclusion clause and why they're stupid and you should avoid them. So Charterhouse Real Estate, our philosophy is short contracts. The industry average is about 6 months. When someone lists their house, The agent wants at least 6 months. I've seen people do as much as a year, which is just ridiculous. When you hire an agent and give them a year to sell your house, that's basically saying you have no confidence this thing is going to sell. It's going to take forever. I would question why you're even on the market if that's the case. But our contracts are 3 months. So basically, we have 90 days or 3 months to get the job done. If 3 months comes and goes, if we don't have your house under contract, you have options at that point. You can relist if you want to, but we don't have that expectation. We tell our clients up front, we're going to succeed for you in 3 months. If we don't, you're free to move on. But basically what there is in most contracts, and if you're looking to hire an agent, this is something to know about for sure and negotiate yourself out of. There's something called an exclusion clause. There might be other names for it depending upon where you are in the country. But basically what it means is while your property is listed, if the agent that's listed the property shows the house to a buyer, they don't have to be the ones to show it. That is, a buyer has just come along and looked at the house. At any time during the listing, that buyer, after the contract is ended, can be protected, basically. So let's say you've listed for 3 months, day 45, someone comes and looks, it's not the right time for them, they go away. And then the contract ends, you decide to list with another agent. So that agent takes over the marketing, time, expense of that, et cetera. And then that buyer comes back another month later down the road while you have a new agent and says, now I want to buy the house. If you have signed an exclusion clause and the previous agent had supplied you with names of buyers that looked at the property when it was listed, then technically speaking, that first agent will still be due the commission. Now, this is stupid for a couple of reasons. One, it puts the new agent in a bind. They're now the agent of record. They basically are marketing, spending money, time, trying to get it sold, and they have to step out of the way and let some old buyer that came back on the new listing, the old agent gets paid. But what about if you've had a price drop? What if the new agent did extra creative marketing that made the buyer look at the house in a different light? It doesn't matter. That new agent doesn't get the credit for it. The old agent, because of that clause, and that clause can be 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. It could be 6 months. And sellers mostly don't know what these things are. So the agent just says, you know, sign here. The seller does. And then they're locked into this agent long after the contract's ended. Our philosophy is when the contract's over, it's over. So we don't do exclusion clauses. We have days of zero on our contracts that say basically you're not tied to us after the contract is over. And frankly, you shouldn't be tied to an agent after your contract is over. So if you're about ready to list your house wherever you live, ask the agent, do you have an exclusion clause? Do you plan to try to protect buyers beyond the expiration date of our contract? If they say that they do, simply tell them that you're not willing to sign that. They have the time of the contract, 3 months or 6 months or whatever it is, opt for three if you can. Tell them they have that many days to sell the house. If they haven't done it by then, you don't want to continue doing business with them after the fact. And an agent might say, well, you know, that's just the way it is. It isn't the way it is. You have an option as a seller to do business the way you want to do business. If they don't want to tweak things for you, find somebody else that was or will, because it doesn't serve you to sign that. It just doesn't make sense. It's only for the benefit of the agent. And it could put you in an awkward position down the road with your new agent. All right, guys, that's it on exclusion clauses. As always, if I can't help you in Central Iowa, which is our home base, we can't help you find an agent anywhere around the country. Once we refer you to that agent, we actually make a little bit of money, which helps us to continue to support Cyclone Fanatic. All right, guys, we'll see you next week.